So as we conclude this morning our series on the Psalms, would you turn to Psalm 1? Psalm 1 today as we conclude. We're going to get into some Christmas sermons in the next couple of weeks, and then Lord willing, in January, I plan to launch into the book of Hebrews. So Psalm 1 today. In our series, we began with several songs of creation. We then explored the seven penitential psalms. Finally, we explored several songs of redemption or messianic psalms. There are, of course, many other additional types of psalms, psalms of thanksgiving, imprecatory psalms, historical psalms, to name a few. But there is a sense in which the entire Psalter is messianic, although some psalms are more explicit than others. So as we conclude today, I really want to focus on the messianic quality of all the psalms. If you were to analyze all the hymns that we sing, you would discover a very strong Christological theme that just runs right through them. Likewise, Jesus Christ is the embodiment of the Psalter. But there is a caveat. The Psalms were written long before the birth of Jesus Christ. Consequently, the Christology of the Psalms is often cryptic or mysterious, to use the New Testament term. The Psalms foreshadow New Testament realities. The life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, suddenly those divine realities just burst right through the types and the symbols and the shadows of the Old Testament. Jesus in the new is the embodiment of the old covenant. Now we've seen this again and again. Jesus as God incarnate is the new Adam embodied, God in flesh, bringing back with him a new humanity, Romans chapter 5. Jesus as God incarnate is the new temple embodied. Destroy the dwelling place of God, he will raise it up in 3 days. Jesus as God incarnate is the new David, the Messiah whose body does not corrupt in the grave, Acts 2. Jesus as God incarnate is the new high priest, a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, Hebrews chapter 7. Jesus as God incarnate is the new Moses. He brings the true manna of eternal life right down out of heaven, John chapter 6. Jesus as God incarnate is the new Passover. This is my body which is broken for you. This do in remembrance, not of the Exodus, but of me, as long as you eat and as long as you drink, Luke 22. And Jesus as God incarnate is Torah embodied. Not one jot or one tittle will pass away until Jesus embodies and fulfills the whole. Friends, at Christmas, we celebrate the incarnation of God into the old creation. That is the destiny of the old covenant. At Easter, we celebrate the incarnation of God into the new creation. That's the destiny of the new covenant. Jesus journeyed through a virgin womb into the old creation and through a virgin tomb into the new creation. And when the disciples suddenly realized what God incarnate had accomplished through a virgin womb and a virgin tomb, they journeyed right across the empire into the ends of the world, preaching the Old Testament with astonishing new insight. That was their Bible, the Old Testament. Entering synagogues, they unrolled the ancient prophetic scrolls, and suddenly they began to see Jesus everywhere. They sang again the ancient songs. They discovered Jesus echoing through their entire Psalter. Jesus is the embodiment of the Psalter. Now, with that in mind, I want you to imagine reading Psalm 1 for the first time after the resurrection. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of Yahweh, and on his law he meditates day and night. He is like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither. In all that he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but are like chaff that the wind drives away. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For Yahweh knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. So who is this blessed man standing at the gateway of the Psalter? As I was preparing this sermon, one of my children walked into my office and noticed Psalm 1 open on my computer screen. I won't say which child, but she asked whether I was going to preach Psalm 1. Yes, after Thanksgiving, I replied. Do you like the psalm, I asked. Yes, she replied, but it does get preached a lot. And I responded, but have you ever thought of it as Christological? And she responded with a question, is it really? You seem to say that about a lot of psalms. I don't want to embarrass her, but in fact, it's a fair question. Should we go looking for Jesus Christ under every rock and behind every tree in the Old Covenant? The New Testament never directly applies Psalm 1 to Jesus Christ. However, Jesus told the disciples in Luke 24, everything written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets, and listen to this, and the Psalms must be fulfilled. Then he opened their minds to understand the Scriptures. So question, if the entire Old Testament back there points to Jesus Christ, do you think the New Testament exhaustively explains every Christological connection between the two Testaments? Well, Jesus invited his disciples to search the Psalms. But in Luke 24, he did not point to any particular psalm. So which one was he talking about? Or which ones? Earlier in the same chapter, Jesus chided two disciples on the road to Emmaus for not seeing him in the Scriptures. But Jesus does not say which passages. In Acts, Luke commended the Berean Jews for diligently examining the Scriptures concerning Jesus Christ, but Luke does not reveal which Scriptures. In John 5, Jesus said, "The Scriptures bear witness about me," but he doesn't tell us which ones. So given these examples, it would seem that we have to search for Jesus Christ, even when the New Testament does not give us all the answers. Now we must, of course, guard against eisegesis. Eisegesis is reading something into the text that the author did not intend. So don't get too fanciful with your interpretations. When the New Testament makes an explicit connection, just accept that on face value. For example, Peter told us last week that Jesus is the rejected cornerstone. You probably would not have seen that on your own, and I would not have either. But Jesus is the rejected cornerstone of Psalm 118. So therefore, that's true. Jesus is the rejected cornerstone. And we saw several explicit connections in Psalm 2, 16, 18, 22, 40, and 45 to Jesus. Now, when the New Testament does not make the explicit connection, we should, in fact, hold our interpretations maybe a little more loosely. Expand our Christology while economizing our dogmatisms. So let's try this today. Might Jesus be the embodiment of the blessed man of Psalm 1. Well, notice the first word, blessed. That's the Hebrew equivalent of the first word of Jesus' first recorded sermon in the New Testament. Blessed. Jesus' Beatitudes are a commentary on that word. And of course, when we work through the Sermon on the Mount, we discovered that Jesus is actually the only true and perfect embodiment of the Beatitudes. The blessed man refuses the counsel of the wicked. The Bible's opening scene reveals the alternative man who succumbed to the counsel of the wicked one, slithering his way through the trees planted by streams of water, yielding fruit in their season. Verse 1 describes the seat of scoffers. Scoffing was Satan's first temptation. Hath God said, you shall not eat of any tree? Well, God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be open and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. Might Jesus be the embodiment of verse 2? The man who delights in the law of the Lord, meditating on it day and night. We just sang about Jesus fasting before temptation this morning. After fasting and meditating on God's law for 40 days and nights, Jesus rebuked the wicked one. Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. Three times the wicked counsel returns, scoffing at God's counsel. But even in his starvation delirium, the law of the Lord just poured from Jesus' lips. So might Jesus be the embodiment of verse 3. Like a tree rooted in the rich soils of God's Word, productive. His leaf does not wither, and all that he does, he prospers. When Jesus made his final Passover journey to Jerusalem, he spied an unproductive fig tree outside the city gate. Outwardly prosperous, but barren and fruitless. The tree symbolized the apostate priesthood of the Sanhedrin, in the Sanhedrin, a religious class who had succumbed to the counsel of the wicked one. The wicked one sees Judas, counseling him to stand in the way of sinners and condemn Jesus to death. The counsel of the wicked conspired to crucify Jesus on a barren tree beyond the city gate. Two trees representing two humanities stood on either side of Jerusalem that fateful day that Jesus was murdered. But Jesus' wretched humanity so graced that ugly tree of death that it has become the most productive and prosperous tree in all human history. From that tree flows a stream of water running on into all eternity. Its leaf does not wither, and it yields abundant fruit. Two trees stand not only on either side of Jerusalem, but at either end of the Bible. Revelation 22:1. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, brightest crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb. Through the middle of the street of the city also, on either side of the river, the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. Friends, if Jesus is not the very embodiment of the blessed man, the perfect embodiment of Psalm 1, who is? Failing to embrace the tree of life, we are all the embodiment of verse 4. The wicked blown like chaff from the threshing floor by a hot desert wind. Apart from Christ, we are the wicked of verse 5 who will not stand in the judgment. So does Jesus stand at the gateway of the Psalter Is he the mystery at the heart of our ancient songs? Well, what about the second psalm? Well, that's easy. The New Testament makes the connection to Jesus explicit. So what about the third? Would you notice the psalm's description? A psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. So guess what Psalm 3 concerns? David when he fled Absalom. That's what the psalm is about. David's son launched a civil war, driving his father from Jerusalem. Psalm 3 is not quoted in the New Testament. So should we even look for Christ in the psalm? Well, I guarantee if Spurgeon was here today, he would. I saw Brother Pettit back there, and Pettit reads a lot of sermons, Spurgeon's sermons, and we've talked several times about Spurgeon on the Psalms. He's good on the Psalms. Would you observe that David cries out to Yahweh 6 times? L-O-R-D in all capital letters, that's Yahweh. The New Testament reveals that Jesus is Yahweh. That term Yahweh turns up approximately 900 times in the Psalter. So at a minimum, all right, if you want to know, does the psalm point to Jesus? At a minimum, everything we learn about Yahweh, we learn about Jesus. David's pattern of calling out to Yahweh in distress in this psalm is an example of how we ought to cry out to Jesus in distress. And by the way, we sang about Jesus' distress a few minutes ago. Do you think that he can help you in distress? Now, that might be the extent of the Christological application of the psalm. But if we listen to the music a little longer, we might discover something more. When we purchased a new violin for my daughter, we took her very talented teacher along with us. And her highly trained ear appreciated the quality of the music in a way that was just lost on me. I'm like, what are you hearing? Okay, I guess I'll buy this one, right? Well, would you notice David's distress in the first 2 verses? O Yahweh, how many are my foes? Many are rising against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God. And verse 6 speaks of many thousands of people who have set themselves against me all around. Friends, might David be using a little bit of hyperbole so that we sympathize with his great distress? Do you know of another Messiah whose experience actually more closely fits this psalm? Would you turn to 2 Samuel chapter 15? And I want to actually go back and investigate the historical setting of Psalm 3. 2 Samuel 15. Reading Psalm 3, you might conclude the whole world turned against David. Everyone was his foe. But actually, that's not true. David had many allies. And let's note them this morning. Verses 1 through 12 describe Absalom's conspiracy. And they climax at the end of verse 12. And the conspiracy grew strong, and the people with Absalom kept increasing. But notice verse 15. And the king's servant said to the king, behold, your servants are ready to do whatever my lord the king decides. Verse 18. And all his servants passed by him, and all the Cherethites, and all the Pelethites, and all 600 Gittites who had followed him from Gath passed on before the king. Now David had earlier slain a Philistine giant from Gath. But notice the incredible loyalty of another Philistine. A Philistine named Ittai the Gittite. Gittite means people from Gath. People from Goliath's town, right? Verse 19. Then the king said to Ittai the Gittite, "Why do you also go with us? Go back and stay with the king, for you are a foreigner and also an exile from your home. You came only yesterday, and shall I today make you wander about with us, since I go I know not where? Go back and take your brothers with you, and may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you. Consider David's kindness to the stranger in his own land." And notice the response. But Ittai answered the king, "As the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, wherever my lord the king shall be, whether for death or for life, there also will your servant be." Can you imagine such loyalty from a Philistine? And here are further allies. Verse 24. And Abiathar came up. And behold, Zadok came also with all the Levites, bearing the ark of the covenant of God. Verse 32. While David was coming to the summit where God was worshipped, behold, Hushai the Archite. Hushai proved essential to turning the tide of war in David's favor. Look at verse 36. Behold, their two sons are with them, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son. These men would serve as spies for David. In chapter 16 and verse 9, we stumble upon Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, who also was allied with David. In chapter 17, verse 17, we learn again of Jonathan and Ahimaaz and an unnamed female servant who stood by David. Then in chapter 17, 27 through 29, we read, "When David came to Mahanaim, Shobai, the son of Nahash, from Rabbah of the Ammonites, and Maker, the son of Amiel, from Lodabar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite, from Rogalim, brought beds, basins, and earthen vessels, wheat, barley, flour, parched grain, beans and lentils, honey and curds, and sheep and cheese from the herd, for David and the people with him to eat. For they said, 'The people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness.'" Would you say David has lots of friends, lots of allies? Well, read the first two verses of 2 Samuel 18 now. "Then David mustered the men who were with him and set over them commanders of thousands." Thousands and commanders of hundreds. Where they all come from? And David sent out the army. One-third under the command of Joab, one-third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and one-third under the command of Ittai the Gittite, the Philistine. David had a whole army on his side. And his old ally, Joab, was there to lead the charge. So would you take that whole context and turn back to Psalm chapter 3. Grieving over his son, David felt like the whole world had turned against him. And no doubt you would too if you lost your own son. But when we interpret the psalm in historical context, does it remind you of Psalm 22? Remember Psalm 22? We looked at it. Psalm 22 was at times explicitly messianic. In fact, it was Psalm 22 that Jesus cried from his cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus took the momentum of that psalm, which was focused on David, and he just changed that momentum so it focused on him. In Psalm 22, David described his suffering with so much hyperbole that really we had no choice but to go on looking for the true embodiment of Psalm 22. Recall that? I mean, there's just so much there. Like, well, David never faced all of this. And we met Christ and we discovered there was no hyperbole in that psalm at all. Christ suffered. Whatever experience David had, Jesus' experience was exponentially greater. So friends, might we do the same thing here with Psalm 3? Again, we're not on quite as firm a ground as we are with Psalm 22 because the New Testament makes it explicit. Psalm 22 pointed to Jesus. But what about Psalm 3? When you read, O Yahweh, how many are my foes? Many are rising against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God. Can you see Jesus in those words? In Jesus' experience, it was not merely his son, but the whole created humanity that rebelled against him and exiled him from Jerusalem on a cross. When I read Psalm 3, I sympathize with David's suffering. I hear the voice of 1,000 martyrs. I read the stories of suffering saints through all the ages. But piercing beyond the veil of those stories of suffering, disease, betrayal, and loss, I see Jesus Christ, the very embodiment of all human suffering. None suffered like him. None were forsaken like him. David was betrayed by Absalom. Jesus was betrayed by us all. So where is Ittai the Gittite? The Gentiles were equally guilty of hanging Jesus on a cross. Where is Joab, the faithful ally? Peter drew his sword once and betrayed him thrice. Where is Abiathar, the priest? The priest condemned Jesus. And where is the army battling its way back to Jerusalem? Jesus faced the supreme enemy alone. And that's why Jesus, not David, is the very embodiment of Psalm 3 and verse 8. Salvation belongs to Yahweh. You, your blessing beyond your people. You see Christ in Psalm 3? Neither Psalm 1 nor Psalm 3 explicitly connect Jesus to the New Testament. But if we have ears to listen to the ancient melodies, we will hear echoes of songs sung loudly in the New Covenant. Now friends, as we prepare our hearts for communion, can we turn to one final psalm, Psalm 23. Psalm 23 this morning. Psalm 23 has provided boundless reserves of mercy for Christians through poverty, miscarriage, persecution, hardship, and death. It's read in hospitals. It's printed on pictures and hung in nursing homes. It's read at thousands of funerals. Why? When you tread through the valley of the shadow of death, do you sense that someone has walked this way before? Verse 1, Yahweh. Now who is Jesus? Jesus, Yahweh is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. And I shall dwell in the house of Yahweh, the house of Jesus, forever. The Psalm Center describes a believer whose experiences of great hardship, including death, are deeply troubling to his soul. Yet he is fortified with steely resolve because his tender and gracious shepherd leads him along. At the center is the grim valley of the shadow of death. But the beginning and the end of the psalm speak of abundant life. And that, friends, is the story of the Bible from Eden to death to the new creation. Now, would you follow Jesus from the upper room into the tragic heart of Gethsemane? Gethsemane was not a modern cultivated garden. It had no manicured lawns, seasonal flowers, or sparkling fountains. Gethsemane was a grove of ancient olive trees, living organisms surviving centuries of beatings until they yielded their fruit. Their gnarled and twisted shapes resemble grotesque gray skeletons. When the darkness is pierced by the traitor's torch, they look like hideous creatures unleashed by an ancient curse. Above Gethsemane stood Herod's temple, its sheets of gold glittering in the fires of animal sacrifice. Two valleys fall away from the ridge of the temple. On the east is the Kidron Ravine. Connecting with the Kidron in the south is the Hinnom Valley, a place where fires smolder continuously, destroying the city's refuse. We know it as Gehenna, or hell. At the confluence of these dark valleys lies the Enrogel Spring, pumping water through the Kidron, running up the eastern side of the temple like a great scar in the landscape. Jesus leaves the upper room. He follows the rim of Gehenna before plunging into the Kidron Ravine. The acrid taste of blood hangs on the air. The Mount of Olives, covered with tombs, rises as he descends. The Kidron was likewise lined with tombs, whitewashed every year in preparation for Passover, but full of dead men's bones. The flames of temple fires transform the tombs into a forest of dark shadows, pointing their long fingers toward the depths of Gethsemane. At Passover, some 600 priests slaughtered thousands of lambs. A quick, muscular blow punctured the heart, releasing a river of blood. Caught in the basin, the blood was splashed against the base of the altar before draining off the temple mount. A quarter of a million gallons of blood tumbled down into the valley with Jesus. The blood mingled with the water spilling out of the Enrogel Spring. A fountain of blood and water drained from the scar in the temple side. But Psalm 118 spoke of a rejected cornerstone. A new fountain of blood and water would drain from another temple. Blood, tombs, the fires of Gehenna, gnarled, twisted trees like so many demons in Dante's Inferno. The shepherd has entered the valley of the shadow of death. It was the darkest place in Jerusalem. And quoting Zechariah, Jesus turned to his disciples and said, "I will strike down the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered." Well, do you sense that someone has walked this way before? Jesus now feels the weight of humanity's sin driving him further downward, down to the depths of the earth. One disciple, like Absalom, has betrayed him already, possessed by the wicked counselor, preparing a tree of death. In an ironic turn, both Absalom and Judas will hang from a tree of death. Peter, James, and John, who witnessed his transfiguration on the mountain, follow him deeper into the dark valley. But the light of the transfiguration, the luminescent clothing, the bright cloud, and the burning voice from heaven are extinguished. Jesus is stricken with unfathomable sorrow. Turning to his disciples, three remain. He exclaims, "Watch with me." And he staggers forward. Those same disciples who fell down on the Mount of Transfiguration, overcome with abject terror, promptly fall down again and fall asleep on Jesus. Jesus, unlike David, is now all alone, absolutely alone in the valley of death outside Jerusalem. Jesus pressed on a few paces. The weight of the world's sin suddenly collapses him to his knees. He falls to his face on the ground. Great drops of sweat burst from his pores, falling like great pools of blood to the ground. Friends, this situation is so critical. The best medical intervention will never do. An angel was quickly dispatched to minister to Jesus, to keep him alive, lest he die prematurely. And Jesus cries out to the Father, "My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." The cup in the Old Testament is associated with suffering, particularly suffering under the outpouring of God's wrath. Understand that Jesus' desperate plea is a testimony to his complete humanity. Jesus does not face death with the passionate longing of some crazy martyr or some crazy fanatic. Human nature naturally shrinks from death, and Jesus is human. But such was his divine mastery over his humanity that at the moment of his greatest trial, he could still cry out, "Not as I will, but as you will, O Father." Jesus' second prayer after discovering the sleeping disciples demonstrates increasing resolve and a resignation to the cup of suffering prepared for him. "My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done." A second episode of discovering the sleeping disciples follows, and then a third prayer. Curiously, in all three recorded accounts of Jesus' prayers in Gethsemane, we have no record of a response from heaven. But in all three accounts of the transfiguration of the mountain, we hear the voice of the Father thundering, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." The heavenly silence in the dark valley foreshadows the deeply mysterious inter-involvement of the Father and the Son at the time of crucifixion. Jesus is totally dependent on the will of the Father, commanding him to the cross, where the Father turns his back on the Son, and the heavens are dark and silent. Jesus' third prayer repeats the resolve of the second, and now fires him with unflinching resolve to go forth and to meet his betrayer in the darkness. Jesus exclaims, "Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." Friends, when you consider Jesus in dark Gethsemane, does Psalm 23 take on a whole new light? When you are confronted with the counsel of the wicked one, Psalm 1, do you sense that someone has endured his temptation before you? When you suffer loss, even the betrayal of a child, do you sense someone has already endured greater betrayal? Psalm 3. Or Psalm 23, when you pass the valley of the shadow of death, do you sense that someone has gone this way before? And Jesus, right there in the heart of Jerusalem, surrounded by enemies, prepared a table for his disciples. And do you sense that on the far side of the valley of the shadow of death, he has prepared a table for us? Shall we pray together? Friends, do we acknowledge Jesus as the very embodiment of the Good Shepherd? Do we acknowledge him as the very embodiment of the Psalter? Anything that's worth singing about in the Old Testament is only sung louder in the New Testament when we greet Jesus Christ.